Vishnu Sahasranama. I believe, are we on 87? Sharma? I didn't do Sharma. I didn't do Sharma, did I?
No.
So go to the 87th Dhamma.
There's a bunch of Sharmas in India.
That's true.
It's nice to know what it means.
Yeah.
That's a long Sharma.
A long day.
Short
right?
One.
Not federal.
Well, the...
Hey, did you get your veggie donut? Your veggie donut?
I did.
I guess that means yes.
Now I'm having a sugar rush. It's good though. It doesn't taste. I mean, it tastes like it's very moist.
It tastes
and
very normal.
Yeah, it tastes normal.
It's a vegan.
Of course,
donut.
We don't know what normal is anymore.
Yeah, I know.
Not normal.
It's like if you have some fake meat, you think, "Oh, this is just like meat," but you have a meat eater eats it and they go. Okay. You ready?
We'll pass on that one.
Repeat after me, Sharma.
Sharma.
So that would actually come from, Sharma would be the, from Sharman, right? But it would be, in the meter, Sharma. Paramananda Rupatwa Sharma.
Paramananda Rupatwa Sharma.
So Sharma. Swamiji says the one who is in the form of Ananda. So if you look at this, that twat ending is the fifth case ending. Because of being in the rupa, in the form of Parama Ananda, supreme, limitless Ananda. Rupa, you have to understand when we use the word rupa, it's not when we say form, in the form of, does it mean a physical form? It means the one whose nature is Parama Ananda. In another context, rupa can actually be the form, like the form of the pot, for instance. But rupa also means the nature of something. So that's important to know otherwise. If you think it's just the physical form or something like that, then that's compressing the meaning too much. That's it. Sharma, the one, because of being the Parama limitless Ananda, Vishnu is called Sharma, the one who is.
When they say limitless Ananda,
Parama.
Huh?
Parama.
Yeah, but what I'm curious about is that limitless Ananda.
Well,
that means that there's not... There's nothing in opposition to it. There's no other.
Well, in Advaita, where's the opposition? So you can also say Parama, and I don't like to use the word supreme, but often for Parama, if you're going to give a little definition of it, they often say Desha, Kala, Vastu, Aparichedaha. That which can't be circumscribed or limited by space, time, or quality. Desha Kala Vastu Aparichedaha. So if we say Parama, Parama Ananda, that Ananda which enjoys no limitation. Right? So every other Ananda that we experience is born of a vritti, vritti Ananda. Those all enjoy limitation in terms of quality, right? And in, of course in terms of time, and they're taking place wherever your antakarana happens to be at that time. So any type of other type of ananda is it belongs to duality and is dependent upon the condition of the mind.
And it will change.
Of course it will change, because it's only the mind which is overwhelmed by sattva that gets to enjoy, that has overwhelmed to some degree by sattva, that gets to enjoy any expression of ananda. Right? Because the... So if you say really... To understand vritti ananda, ananda which is there manifest in a vritti, in a thought modification, that ananda is taking place, is being experienced because the vritti enjoys some shanti. Means it's not rippling, there's no agitation there, there's not like mud thrown in it like we use the bucket, the water bucket analysis, or an analogy, if there's mud thrown into water, a water bucket, then the reflection of the sun in the water will be dimmed and not true to the sun. If the water is agitated, then the sun will also not be true to its nature, the reflection. The sun remains the sun. Right? But the reflection is different. And so the experience of the mind, from the standpoint of the mind, from the standpoint of the vritti, right, alters from a dim sun to almost a sun that's barely visible. When somebody is, say, highly depressed, for instance, it's barely visible, right? Because the muddy water is so much. The agitated mind, we'd call that like a manic state. The mind is so manic, you know, that it could be a manic depression, or it can be like an agitated depression, or it can be like a manic state in that what is the name of that? Gosh. You know, when you manic go from bipolar. Thank you. Bipolar condition. Okay?
Right, and the word manic means like totally overwhelmed.
Manic means, in fact, people who are bipolar love their manic states because there's so much energy and yet there's no depression. And so it's a high. It's a high, but then you're overwhelmed by the energy, and it's numinous. It feels numinous, like so powerful. You feel so powerful because there's so much ananda and clarity, like bliss. It's like a bliss state with a very agitated mind, and then you get totally overwhelmed by that state of mind where you totally believe in it. Like if that mind is telling you, now I'm going to be wealthy. I'm going to be the most wealthy person in the world through this stock trade. And so I'm going to do it. There's no question. I know what I'm doing, you know. Or I'm going to buy this real estate now because this real estate will make me wealthy, will make me this and that, and I know it for certain. And so you do it. Or you go on shopping sprees. These are all examples that they use. You go on wild shopping sprees. Because money is no issue.
It's the norm of the world, though.
Yeah. No, but this is totally, if we're talking about these manic states, it's totally out of sync with the reality of your condition.
It yeah. sounds like a little
But for bit, you, it's totally real.
It sounds a little bit like a kind of a drug dose.
Yeah, it's like an intoxication almost.
Yeah,
power.
Kind of.
Does it come from manas? The word manas?
No, I don't know. No. Anyway, we're just talking.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm just here. Well, all we're doing is differentiating the Padma Ananda that is not subject to any type of modification from the different types of vrittis that can take place in the mind. Those vrittis are Desha Kala Vastu Paricheda. They're limited by space and by time and by quality. You can have a vritti that is kind of peaceful, a little bit of shanti, or extreme shanti, or you're feeling okay, or you're in a bliss state, or you're in depression. So the vrittis go on modifying, go on changing. And so your experience of ananda comes and goes, and also the quality of the ananda that you're experiencing comes and goes. Also, you may be experiencing ananda, and the other person may not. Right, so that's the desha. Your vritti, the vritti that you're happening to have at this moment, is giving you the experience of ananda, of happiness, some level of happiness, variegated levels of happiness, but the other person is really sad, right? Because their vritti is different. But the Padma Ananda is the ananda, the nature of your being, which is there always the same and is always there as the satchit of every satchit ananda, of every vritti that you have, every vritti, whether it's a dukkha vritti or a sukha vritti, the Satchitananda Atma is self-evident and present completely in every vritti, no matter what the quality of the vritti. And so that's why the word ananda, the use of the word ananda, is difficult, because the word ananda is translated as bliss. And so now, knowing that Brahman is Satchitananda, I'm looking for a bliss state. But I'm looking for a bliss state, of course, only in reference to the vrittis, because that's all I know. And so my mind should go from these fluctuating vrittis to reach this Padma Ananda bliss state in the form of a vritti. That is the huge problem that's, in terms of teaching this knowledge, that's one of the huge problems in making it clear, because people aren't really attached to being, or even to conscious being. Conscious being, if it's sad, who wants that? Mm-hmm. Conscious being, if it's an abstraction like space, who wants that? You know. So it's only conscious being, the set chit, which is me, and which is Ananda, full and complete. Not me, which is sad. Or not me, which is agitated. Or not me, which is subject to loss. Mm-hmm. So these are all vritti conditions. So that means that in the viveka, we say viveka jnanam. Knowledge really is viveka jnanam. Means discriminative. You have to discriminate. And the whole teaching methodology has to do with the differentiation of your being, which is constant and present to every vritti. What that means is that the word Ananda, the word Ananda, is talking about something which is ever present, no matter what the vritti. And so that means that some viveka has to take place, and also your understanding of the meaning of the word Ananda has to be sought out in reference to the constancy of your own being. You have to ask this question, why do they call me, this me, Ananda? Because it's not a bliss state, you know. It's not variegated, it doesn't go from bliss, more bliss, the most bliss, like that, you know. But they use this word Ananda for me, for my presence. What in this condition right now, assuming nobody's in some bliss state, whatever state of mind is there right now, your being is present to it. You are there. You are there as its very self. What do they mean by Ananda, here and now? That's what you have to look for.
It's in a different category, totally. I mean,
it's a different category in the self, that the Satchitananda Atma is not coming and going. It's not subject to change. It's not objectification. It's not objectifiable. It's a subject-object relationship. It's never not there. It's self-evident. You know, this Svatta Siddha, conscious being, is self-evident. And so this self-evident being has to be differentiated. Once you differentiate it, then as just the set chit, you differentiate it as the set chit, then your mind can ask, okay, here's the set chit me, why do they call me Ananda? Mm-hmm. When you recognize the stability of your own presence, no matter what the vritti, why is that termed Ananda? That's a good question to ask. Then then the mind can work on that a little bit, you know? Maybe the answer, one way of answering that, but that has to be recognized by you, is in fact, there is nothing more dear or more beloved than your own being. You would give up a sukhavritti before you would give up your own being. Right?
Yeah.
So what is most dear? What is the most dear? The most dear is that which is most loved. We don't love dukkha. That's a given. We don't love dukkha. We're not in love with dukkha. We're not in love with suffering or with sorrow or with agitation or with loneliness or with depression. All the negative spectrum, we're not in love with that. Right? And in fact, in the spectrum of vrittis, we are very comfortable with the positive spectrum, which are all vrittis which resonate with your own being. Like the clear water bucket resonates, not the sun. The reflection is not the sun, but it's also not at odds with the reflection. There's no dissonance there, right? And so we're perfectly fine with the positive spectrum, no matter what the thinking is, as long as it's within that positive spectrum in terms of affect, we're quite at home. And the more subtle the mind is, means the more shanti is there in the mind, the more at home we are. So I meditative states, you know, when on an unconscious level and a conscious level, there's shanti there, where we love that. We don't want to even come out of that. We want to come out, but we want to keep that, you know, that ananda there, that fullness there in the mind. So that ananda, that one that is most dear, if you ask yourself, what is the most dear, what is the most beloved, then you notice maybe what we mean by ananda. And that which is most beloved, then when you understand actually that most beloved, most dear, that actually is Ishvara, in terms of the self of Ishvara. Not Maya. When we say Ishvara, we're not talking about the Maya Upadi, we're talking about the truth of Ishvara, which is the most beloved. So it's beautiful. If you have an Ishtadevata, understanding that self as the self of your Ishtadevata also is very beautiful, because that Ishtadevata is always there completely with you. In fact, as this knowledge becomes clear, that Atma, it which is Brahman, is what is here. So what is actually here is Ishvara. That's why we're doing little meditations now, just to continue to recognize that the conscious being that is you, it is you, but that you, right, is the one you, the one self in all beings, is really Ishvara. And so there's something very very beautiful about that. Because you're never away from Bhagavan.
And can you say that same thing about the unconscious? I mean, I can see where it works with the conscious mind.
The unconscious, you have to learn how to work with the unconscious, because the unconscious has to do with little traumas and things that have been split off in your past experiences that you as the conscious mind has to go in and retrieve those, come into dialogue with them, so that they can release the pain and the trauma that they're holding. Right. And so the little ones inside are not little jnanis.
Yeah.
They need to be cared for and loved, right? So that they're split, like Jung will say, they're like split off parts.
Yeah.
They're split off. They have some autonomy, not fully, because they can't replace the conscious mind, but they have some autonomy, they have some limited consciousness. That's why when you go in and come into dialogue with them, you can actually bring them back as you love them.
Yeah.
They need to be loved. They need to be loved and respected, not hurt anymore. They need to be loved. And then in that love relationship, good parent relationship, the hurts will dissipate. It's just... You think of it like, for those of you who have children or nieces or nephews or little children that you've worked with, been with, when they get hurt and they're so upset, unbelievably upset, you can't even imagine how upset a little one can get. The whole body is shaking and screaming and crying. But if you are there as their parent who loves them and is patient, you know, they go through their total tantrum. But as you love them and are there with them and comforting them, and it goes away, and then they run off. You know? And they're fine. There is no problem. You know? But it's because they've been contained by somebody who loves them and respects them and cares and is willing to be with them as they go through that scare, whatever it was. But say you say instead, oh, for heaven's sakes, go
get
to your room.
Get over it.
Go to your room. Go to your room. Go to your room. Okay? Yeah. Then that little child has to kind of do something with that. And on top of it, they're hurt. So that trauma has been now in a shell casing of hurt. And so then what do they do? Well, they don't know what to do. And so the unconscious does it for them. Comes in with a defense system and it says, you can't handle this. And it sucks it in, and it puts it into the unconscious. And it just stays there, protected by the defense system. But then that hurt will project out if there's something in the world that triggers it. That hurt projects out onto that situation. And that hurt that's contained inside, it's a little child's hurt, which is monstrous compared to the size of the little child, so it's a huge hurt that's been, because of the capacity of the little child, you know, so it's huge for that little child. That hurt, then if something triggers it, overwhelms the ego, the conscious mind. By ego here, psychologically, the conscious mind. And then you look around and say, look at what's happened to me. Because now it's I'm just experiencing the terrible pain, but in the real time of this situation that I find myself in. And so what we have to learn, then that goes on endlessly. Because the unconscious, the pain is there in the unconscious, and it doesn't wear out. It's doing just fine there. Nothing's happening to it. You know? So just again and again and again, you can be 80 years old and still, there you are. Until you are able to go in, that conscious mind can go in, especially when some hurt like that gets triggered, the conscious mind can say, okay, what's really happening? What's really happening? And you go and you speak to that, and you go in to that little child, and you be with it. And you give the child what you would give your child out here. You be with that child and tell, let it talk to you and explain the whole situation and cry and have, you know, a loving parent who loves you and respects you and, you know, will be there. And then that energy will release. It releases, and the part that's kind of sequestered, that libido, that psychic energy, actually joins back into the conscious mind. So there's a relief there.
Now you talked only about the individual mind and this problem.
Yeah.
But what about the collective unconscious or collective?
Are you talking about Jung?
Yeah, or? Not necessarily.
Oh, okay.
Because so men have different mental makeups according to their time and their living conditions.
Yeah.
And so it's not only matters from individual, but also of collective, because an individual is raised within a community which has certain mental subconscious problems.
Yeah.
And it could also be something positive, because different mentalities of nations distinguish each
well, the positive things are something that the ego can handle. The conscious mind can handle those things that are positive. So those usually aren't things that are sequestered. The only way, reason something positive is sequestered in the unconscious is if the parent, for instance, when the child is young, doesn't see that quality as positive because of their own problems. They see that quality as, oh, the child is just full of herself. She has too much pride. She's too bossy, she's too this, she's too that. And so things that actually could be beautiful qualities, if they're, you know, if they're honored, instead the child is made to feel that that's a bad thing. And so things that could actually be beautiful are put into the unconscious because she's been, or he's been punished for those things because of the orientation of the parent. So that's what we call a golden shadow.
But
usually it's negative.
But is it necessarily negative?
Well, only in this sense. What I mean by negative is that when that experience took place, it was not something the conscious mind could handle. Because it was scary or painful in some way, and went above and over the threshold that was okay for the conscious mind. Because so many things, positive and negative, are easy for us to handle. They don't need to be sequestered. But for a young child, the experiences are bigger. So if these things going into the unconscious usually happen at a young age, not at an adult age. Like the first 7 years before logic really sets in, at least psychologically, that's what they say. So usually what will cause it is just for that little child, it could be a simple thing, and not even any fault of the parents. It has to do with how the child reacted. So if something scared the child and they couldn't handle it, the unconscious sucks it in.
But now the unconscious is always negatively referred to by you.
No, because from a Jungian perspective, there are layers to the unconscious.
Yeah.
We would say, so all of these psychologies have different models, okay? But I'm talking about Jung, and that's the one that, I don't know, resonates the most with me, even though it has to be adapted to Vedanta in some ways. That's what my dissertations were about. But anyway, for Jung, there are levels to the unconscious, And the baseline, the bottom level, is called the objective psyche, or the collective unconscious. By collective unconscious, they don't mean the collective unconscious of all beings, like one big Ishwara or one big Hiranyagarbha. They don't mean that. By collective unconscious, they mean objective psyche, which means the psychic blueprint for all human beings, like all cats also, what are their psyche? They would have a cat objective psyche, right? So the objective psyche is really comprised of archetypes. So the archetypes are really the instincts, like the instincts that are common to the physical body. The archetypes are parallel to that, but on level of the psyche. And so there are many, many different archetypes which, in a sense, program our experience, right? They allow us to do the input that comes in or coming in through that archetypal grid. And the way that we respond also is, in many ways, coming out through that archetypal grid. So that's the objective psyche, like similar to the instincts for the body. But now, above that objective psyche, there are layers, like Jung gives them kind of anthropomorphic types names, like the wise old man, wise old woman, the trickster, the anima animus. So there's these type of layers, but those layers have a certain numinosity, means they shine with consciousness and brilliance. And like if you had a dream that was taking place on one of these layers, or on the layer of the objective psyche, it would be numinous, and you would think, this is a special dream. But these layers are coded by what we call the shadow. And what the shadow is our personal unconscious. So, say, and usually that is negative, or if it's a golden shadow, it's been unfortunately sequestered because my parents didn't appreciate it as anything positive, and so I've been humiliated around that particular attribute. And so then it's held back. So now, this shadow material kind of coats all of these archetypal nodes. And so say, for instance, I had mother problems, whatever they may be, in the archetype, which we would call the mother-daughter or mother-son dyad. Most archetypes are relational, so it would be a dyad. Whatever problems I had in my personal life, shadow, would congregate there, around that archetypal node. Father, child, around that archetypal node. Religious, because Jung will say that relationship between the individual and God, that can be very damaged also by false theologies which don't work for you at all. Or say you grow up, for instance, you grow up with your parents belonging to one religion that doesn't make any sense to you, but another religion does. Well, that nonsensical religion, which for one, whatever reason, doesn't resonate with you, creates a negative relationship with the God image, right? And so that's shadow material, because that's painful. You know, where I don't have a breathing relationship between the individual and God, which is considered an archetypal relationship. Or what about between the individual and my family? Or the individual and my society? What if it doesn't resonate with me? Then even as a child, it creates dissonance. And so those things are congregating around these archetypal nodes. And therefore, when I'm doing any type of work with my psychology, the first thing they say we have to do is come into relationship with personal unconscious, which is called the shadow. And usually the shadow is going to be the repository for the different hurts, you know. And so coming into relationship with it, I have to come in and as kind of a good mother or a good father or a good mentor, or a good
friend,
you know, that meets that pain, in a way that is trusting, so that all of that material, that little broke, cut off piece of the psyche, can talk to me and cry and.
It's a reparenting, isn't
it? It's like a reparenting.
It doesn't always talk. It doesn't have English. It doesn't.
When it doesn't have English, that means that the trauma takes place before the child could talk, and then it's about holding those feelings and talking to it. You know how you talk to your little baby. You love your baby.
And what about tribes or groups of people who have a certain religious idea of a punishing God or whatever? The hang up of certain religious groups that you had so many in your country. So then.
We do.
Yeah, the freaks went out to America, no? And not only the freaks, but many of them. And they have a strange conception of God sometimes. They often related to the Old Testament or the furious God.
Yeah, yeah.
And then these groups would.
But you know, the Christian took the furious God out of Yahweh and put it into Satan.
Oh, right, yeah. But many Christians also, like the Puritans, had strange ideas.
Yeah, very.
And now they all live collectively.
Yeah.
Then they're all suffering from the same shadow, is that so?
Yes.
And that would be a collective shadow.
Yes, and this is, well, yes, in the sense that they all, because they're, now this is a very important. Joe Henderson, who was he's now passed away, but he lives here, he was doing analysis into his 90s, and he worked with you. He came up with what we call the cultural unconscious, because of this, because everybody in a given culture or a given religion is, you know, brought up in that same conditioning, and so it's something that is over the objective psyche, but it's also under, in a sense, the shadow, because everyone is equally kind of suffering from that religion, especially when the religion doesn't really match with reality or with the psychology of the psychological underpinnings of a human being, then, you know, I mean, that's problematic. And so you might be interested in reading what Joe Henderson says about that, because that's a really important, the cultural unconscious, yeah. And that cultural unconscious, see, like even here in the world, as the world is now, like Swamiji will say, it's in Kali Yuga, the world consciousness, and you can look at every given country, is suffering from a dharma, at least from the model of Kali Yuga, with what we will say is in Kali Yuga, the cow of dharma is standing on one leg. And so that means that a lot of our value systems that are operational for us are actually the value systems of Rakshasas, or they're Asuric value systems.
No kidding.
You know. So, but we've also, as a culture, I'm not talking just about the United States. I'm talking about the world. Our culture. Instead of maybe, you know, valuing teaching and knowledge and all of the qualities as our highest value, you know, where in our heart we would be doing namaskar to the sannyasins and to the priests and to the people who are holders of dharma. Those would be the people that we admire, you know, and honor. But what about when the people that we want to be like are the wealthy people or the power holders? Because that becomes our highest value. It's more, instead of the brahmanas or the kshatriyas, it's the vaishyas that have to do with corporate money and wealth and the 1% and all of that. That's all Kali Yuga. You know, because the value system is very focused upon material gain, which brings in so much raga dvesha. Likes and dislikes, which brings in krodha, kama and krodha, desire and anger. When my kamas, when my desires aren't fulfilled, then it comes in krodha, anger, and upsetness and the whole negative spectrum. So in this chapter 16 and 17 of the Bhagavad Gita, which we've done here, that is amazing to read that, because how old is the Bhagavad Gita? It's a very, very ancient text. It's an ancient text. And they are talking about the human emotions that we experience here today. Both the emotions and value systems of the people who are committed to Dharma, and the value systems of asuras and rakshasas, all of them were there. The difference is we all have all of them, but where is your commitment? That's why Krishna bothers to teach about all of these, because you can recognize them in yourselves. The difference is if you're a sattvika, then you recognize them and you don't want that. If you're a rajasic, or say you're a rakshasa or an asura, that value is your value. It's not that you don't want it. This is what you hold. This is the value that you have.
Yeah.
And so, in Kali Yuga, the cow of Dharma is not steady.
Teetering.
Unbalanced. Mm-hmm. Just imagine having to walk around on one leg. If you're a four-legged animal, you could barely manage with two, you know. So if this cult, this is the cultural slime that every one of us has to rise out of. And that's why Krishna says, for a person to be a mumukshu in Kali Yuga needs to be honored. And Bhagavan says, and I will help you. If you're a mumukshu in this Kali Yuga, I will do everything I can to make things easy for you. The antakarana shuddhi that you need, you can gain that by just chanting the Hari Rama mantra. You know? You don't have to do this and this and this. You just be simple. I will help you.
So, but we're working on our personal unconscious, not the collective.
No, but the question is very important, because we are born into that collective unconscious in a sense. Means the value system that the whole culture, the beliefs, and the value system that the whole culture permeates the whole culture, right? And so, it's kind of like, they use the example, Jung often uses the example of the fish swimming in water, you know, the fish in water doesn't recognize the water because they're totally in the water. Mm-hmm. Wherever they are, there's water, so they don't recognize it. Mm-hmm. And we also are born into a culture that everybody is swimming in that culture, more or less. And so to come into to be able to differentiate yourself from the values of the culture requires a conscious act. That's what Jung will start talking about in terms of individuation. There's a conscious act involved in coming into relationship with those cultural values, because until you do, they're just a given. Jung will call it the containing myth. The containing myth is the water that you're born into, and there's a cultural unconscious there. You're just born into it. You take it for granted. It's just like breathing. You don't even think about it until you do. And in the process of individuation, from a Jungian standpoint, this differentiation is something, you know, that happens in reference to everything. And for us as mumukshus, jnanis, as you gain knowledge, this differentiation is going to happen for all of these things that Jung talks about. Subject, but it also differentiates the body, mind, sense organs, the ahankara itself. So everything is now on the level of Vedanta is differentiated from the Satchitatma. From Jung, it's different. We can use Jung in psychology, but he's certainly not a Vedantin. For Jung, the ego is the conscious mind. That's what he means. The devata of the conscious mind is the ego for Jung. And his process of individuation comes about by coming into differentiation with all levels of your experience, especially in terms of the experiences of the different realms of the psyche, differentiating the conscious mind from the shadow, the conscious mind from the different layers like the animus, from the trickster, from the wise old man, wise old woman, and coming into relationship which with what he calls the God image. That's a big topic there, but what he calls the God image. And that process is the process of individuation. Whereas for us, he won't acknowledge that there's one. He's not a Dvaita at all. It's not that he is or isn't. He's not in that realm. So it's not what he's dealing with. But for us, this process of differentiation of Viveka goes all the way to who you are, as the Satchitatma. So even the knower known duality is objectified. The knower as well as the known, both are objectified. Because consciousness is not a knower, it's the self of the knower and the self of the known. But what's interesting is that this process of viveka, discrimination, has to take place. Otherwise, your being is identified with this anyonya adhyasa, with whatever it is you haven't differentiated yourself from. For Jung, it's the same thing, but it's the conscious ego needs to differentiate itself from all experiences of the unconscious so it comes into relationship with it. And that is the process of individuation. You'll actually have a model of the self, the God image, which is within duality, and the ego contained within it. So in English, we say the ego contained within the unconscious at birth, and then slowly goes through a process of differentiation until it comes into relationship with it. Otherwise, it remains contained. There's no differentiation. And so ours is very similar in terms of the need for differentiation. Even in psychology in general, we have to have that differentiation with unconscious material. Otherwise, there's no one to be present to that unconscious material. I just am that. Right?
So that it's split off with Jung is a whole ego, right? And it's split off with Vedanta is from the self.
No, from the self there's no split off. So when we're talking about this split off from the ego, we're talking about when you have, say you take the ego as a conscious mind, the little baby conscious mind has some sort of a trauma, then it's as though a little part of the ego, the conscious mind that was experiencing that, because in a way he equates consciousness with the conscious mind, and so the conscious mind that was experiencing that is split off and has a certain amount of autonomy there in the psyche. So say, look at your conscious mind as what Jung means by consciousness. Okay, is the conscious mind that is accruing consciousness through its experience. This isn't Vedanta, so the conscious mind. And then that conscious mind that is here right now, it's vritti, gets shocked. It's hurt. And so you can't handle it. So the defense system will, in a sense, split off that vritti and store it and lock it up, you know, because your conscious mind is not able to handle it. And now we don't want all of this energy stored away in our unconscious. It's actually, many psychologists will say it's actually stored in, this unconscious is really stored in the body, the physical body. So then what we do is go into this type of inner child work or active imagination, go in and come back into relationship with that little autonomous part. And so with love and trust, that part will be able to be released.
Freedom.
And that automatically happens when
you're... Are you going to put your headphone on? I just realized it's not on. You might not be able to hear.
Does that automatically take place when there's care and love for the...
When it's conscious. Yeah, it will. If it's consciously done.
You have to be committed.
So you don't
have
to... You don't have to educate the unconscious. It'll just...
The unconscious is there. It needs to just be related to... Sorry, just a second.
What's going on?
Nothing, I think we're okay.
Now, there's another dimension still in Vedanta, or at least in English thinking. If you consider the concept of rebirth, so each individual is characterized by certain in everyday language of Berkeley would mean hang-ups he brought over from another existence, but also of excellences.
Yes.
Former existences.
Totally.
I think of the great geniuses that composed with, like Mozart.
Yeah, yeah.
Composed.
That's right.
Very early age.
Yeah.
So the individual mind is made up by individual experiences, by collective experiences, and traits that one received from former existences.
Well, I think what the Vedanta would say
yes.
about that is that what is the jiva, if I can talk about this really, on another level there is no jiva, the jiva is a product of ajnanam, but if we say the jiva that transmigrates, the components that are actually transmigrating are the like the different parts of the mind itself, the sense organs, the organs of action, the prana. So there's like 18 or 19 components that are transmigrating. So the five pranas. Because they're subtle.
Mind.
They're subtle, right?
And one is mind. And mind
yes.
Is,
and mind has four parts.
It's also a result of former experiences.
Well, yes, in this sense. In this sense, yes.
And these former experiences...
But they don't...
Somehow shape the way I see reality presently. At present.
To a degree, I think more they would say like this, that you will bring forward into this life what we call samskaras.
Yeah.
And samskaras means tendencies.
Yes.
You know, but they're not going to be in the form of memories. They'll
no,
be in the form of tendencies. Right. And so that's why you can have prodigies. You know, say they were a great musician when they passed away. Those samskaras can be there in the child, and so it's very natural for that child to play, or in tennis, or anything. You know, there can be different types of prodigies in every field where somebody's very, very adept, even at the youngest age. So those are samskaras. There can also be other kinds of tendencies, like we say, why is one person good in math, and another person doesn't really like math, they love history. They have different things that they're drawn to. Those are what we call samskaras. Then they say also, in the whole psychological system, under the citta, which is memory, so we have four major types of thoughts that belong to the mind. One is the ahankara, that I notion. One is the buddhi, means intellectual, clear thinking, not doubtful thinking, but clarity. Knowledge, clarity is the buddhi. Then the manas is the emotional life, and also the negative emotional life, and also doubt, or indeterminate thinking. And then the citta. The citta is memory. But then if we look at the citta in terms of what type of memories are there, there's included in that must be the sancitta karmas. The sanchitta karmas have to do with punya and papa that collected from beginningless time of the jiva, which have not yet fructified. And so that sanchitta karma, which must be a huge amount, beginningless time.
Where are you placing that, right?
In the citta.
Okay.
Because that's going to always be with you. That sanchitta karma will always be traveling with you, so just put it in the citta. So... at the time of death, what the Shastra says about this, and you know, I'm not going to add to it, because I don't know, this is what the Shastra says. At the time of death, when you're leaving the body at that last moment of life, there is really no free will. There is just simply who you are at that moment. It's kind of what they say is at that last moment of life is the culmination of who you are, right? And all your highest values, everything will just be there, so to speak, at that moment. And as you pass from this life to the next, there is going to be attracted to this person, the sanchitta karmas, that match you. So that's why, like, this moment is a natural progression from the last moment, when you leave this body. you will be going along your way. You know, so there's a continuity. And so that's why the sanchitta karmas that come now in the form of the prarabdha karma will determine what the next birth that you have. In the meantime, in between you're actually taking another birth, you can be exhausting karmas in all of the different lokas.
So we
kind
don't
of like
have
a
to,
dream.
We don't have, at the moment of death, we don't have to coach ourselves to get ready for that. And, you know,
well, people do. People do. And in India, you know, when the loved one is ready to pass away, their family will usually be chanting something, Narayana, 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 or something, so that to help influence that last moment, you know. Not that it will, but that's the beautiful tradition.
So if you've gone into dementia in the last part of your life,
well, then definitely who you are in terms of the subtle body is going to be whatever it is. It's not going to be... The dementia is caused by the brain, right? Not by the subtle body. And so it's when the subtle body is leaving, it's going to attract its sanchitta karma. Not the physical body is not attracting the sanchitta. The subtle body is attracting the sanchitta to keep it moving on. So that's
now,
what they say.
Your next existence, which includes also habitual ways of thinking, or talents, or propensities, all this is the result of something which is unconscious and is carried into the next existence.
Well, we're using... We have to be careful because we're now using some Western terms for Indian ideas. So now when you say unconscious, if we want to say the sanchitta is in the unconscious, then yes, but then we're talking about the sanchitta in the unconscious.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's going to be different than even the collective unconscious or the shadow.
Yeah, certainly. And all this together... shapes, cement.
I think it does, that's right. So talk about, instead of the unconscious, we could say the samskaras that carry over. Like the samskaras would be those tendencies or way of being that are very dominant in you. And so say if you have mastery over something, you've spent years developing that will be dominant. Say you're a scholar and you've spent your lifetime studying certain subjects. That will be dominant, you know, because you've lived with it. But tendencies also, maybe emotional tendencies, that type of thing, which are dominant, those can be passed on in samskaras. Things that are not dominant are not going to be passed on because they're not dominant. They're incidental.
But the samskaras, in effect, operate like unconscious tendencies.
We even can call them... Sometimes, this is a little to the side, but we say subtle likes and dislikes. If we say that what we call vasanas in this life are subtle likes and dislikes, which they're no longer about a particular thing. They're a samskara. You know, like if somebody raises their eyebrow in a certain way, it triggers a like or dislike in me or a response in me. You know, that I won't even necessarily recognize unless I go in and work on that to associate with it. So we can say, in terms of what's coming over from the last life, in terms of tendencies, you know, we can say, oh, maybe I'm bringing that over from the last life. You don't know for sure, right? But you can kind of have that belief system. Because it can make sense to you, but it's a belief system.
In an unconscious way, it influences my present existence.
I think so. Yeah, it's unconscious in that it's there as the very fabric of your being this time. Like, yeah, like each one of us who have taken our birth, we are all very different. We have kind of different emotional... way we behave emotionally, we have different intellect, we have different skills. So why aren't we all just cookie cutter? We're not. You know, and so you can say a lot of samskaras have come, we've brought over, you know.
So, wait, a lot of times you measure yourself according to failure or success. That doesn't, you make it sound like it, that doesn't apply. It's a bigger pattern going on.
Well, the measuring in terms of failure and success, that's part of the cultural unconscious.
Yeah.
You know, which just has to be overcome. But that's something that in the Bhagavad Gita and all of these texts is trying to get you to have some objectification over that so that that's no longer something, I'm a failure at this or I'm a success at that. Swamiji would always say, you know, you're learning this, whatever it is. It's not about success and failure. You know, in that sense, we're failing all of the time, but every time we fail, we're learning something. So you're not looking at yourself as a success or failure. You're looking at yourself as somebody who's continuing to grow. So this success-failure way of relating to yourself is something that should be changed.
And if you dislike or like somebody irrationally, that can also be...
Then when you have that irrational like or dislike, you can go inside and do this inner child work and say, now what is it really? What is this really about? What is it that, what is really bothering me? And then you get into a dialogue, and then often your unconscious will, or that part will talk to you and tell you about it.
Yeah.
You know?
So when you do that inner child work and you release these things that have been held back in unconsciousness, does that mean that those things don't move forward into the next life?
Not everything moves forward into the next life, first of all. It's not like the whole of you and all of your experiences here get transferred into the next life, because there's more or less a clean slate. Though the sanchitta karmas are causing you to take this physical birth in the main trajectory of your life, and there are some skaras, you know, tendencies, but those would be the dominant qualities of who you are, can come forward, especially, like I said, in terms of knowledge or skills or just emotional ways of relating. You can have certain sensitivities like that, but it's not going to be something specific, right? So that's not going to come over. Like, you shouldn't be having, if you're having memories of what you did in your last life, that's an anomaly. That shouldn't be happening. That shouldn't be happening. It does happen for some children, you know. It does happen. But that's supposed to close over, so you're freed from that. Because otherwise you're carrying, there are some people that does stay open. And then that's problematic, and they have to somehow work that out. Like, go see where they were born and go through all of that, because that hasn't closed over. It's actually supposed to close over.
But are you always reborn as the same species?
You're born not as the same gender, not necessarily the same culture, not necessarily. You may be born as an animal or an insect just in order to, or as a devata, just in order to exhaust karma. But then eventually you'll come back to having a human birth. But it doesn't, The culture is not a given. The gender is not a given.
The planet is a given. So
the planet's not a given either. What will happen if when... Yeah. I'm saying that for the health of this planet, which is dying. Yeah.
And on top of it, this is a question of a theory, because the absolute...
Yeah.
Atman doesn't change.
No.
So
there's no transmigration for the Atma.
Yeah.
The Atma is the changeless being of the whole creation.
Only the individual makeup is changing.
Only the sukshma sharira is transmigrating.
Yeah.
And then also the samskaras, you know, like, for instance, this is the way to understand samskaras. Say you were a great pianist in your last life, but by the time of your death, you're no longer really interested. You're a great pianist, but you're no longer interested in that. Right? And so you may be born with that samskara, but without an interest. You know? Like say you were a great tennis player, but by the end of your life, you were a great tennis player, but you don't have any passion for it anymore. It's nice, tennis is great and all of that, but you have no passion for it. You don't want to be a professional tennis player. That's over. It's like you lived through that, it's done.
Mm-hmm.
But you could carry that, because it was dominant, you could carry that samskara into the next birth, but not have a desire for it. So some people are so good, you think, oh, you should really study piano. You are a natural. And the person says, that's not what I want to do. They may play piano and enjoy, that's not what I want to do. So, you see what I mean? So now the next life, that's a particular samskara that was carried into this life, is not going to be carried into the next life because it's simply not dominant.
But if you're a mumukshu, that carries over, right?
Well, what they say in the shastras, the mumukshutvam is different,
yeah.
Right? Because when you become a mumukshu, you're crossing a line that actually takes you out of the whole samsara because you're no longer the passion, the pravritti, right, is no longer directed outward as a raga, dvesha, let me have this so that I can be happy, and oh, if I could have that so I could be happy. That, once you become a mumukshu, that is no longer dominant. What is dominant for you as a mumukshu, in spite of whatever shortcomings you may have and all the things we're working on, the dominant samskara is mumukshutvam until that is resolved. Right? The other things, you've lost the passion for. That's what has brought you to mumukshutvam. If you still have passion, thinking, oh, now if I could just have this, or I could just go to Swargaloka, or if I've just become good in this, that's really what I want. If I can do that, I would be so happy. That would do it for me. That's samsara. Okay? So then, when you have that type of passion, you can take another birth with that, whatever work you've done to accomplish that, then maybe you can pick it up in your next life. If you're a mumukshu, the samskaras are not going in that direction. They're going, you know, toward antakarana shuddhi, toward moksha. And so now you are no longer an adhikari for the karmakanda, for the first portion of the Vedas.
Yeah.
Or for samsara. You're not a qualified student for samsara. You're not qualified for it anymore. You are now qualified for moksha. Okay? Because you're a mumukshu. Now, if you're not a mumukshu, then this is a dead point. But if you're a mumukshu, you're now qualified for moksha. And so that means that if there has not been a great amount of clarity, you know, there's still things to be accomplished. You're not, the psyche has not matured to the point of just resolution into as Ishwara, resolution into Ishwara. Mm. That hasn't matured to that point yet. Then you will take another birth, which is conducive to those samskaras, the mumukshutva samskaras. Which means, as Krishna says, you will either be born in a house of jnanis, yogis here, meaning jnanis, this is in the Bhagavad Gita, and pick up the thread from a very young age, or based upon your karmas, there'll be some things for you to exhaust. You'll exhaust those things, whatever they may be, and then when they're exhausted, you'll meet your teacher, and then you'll continue on. That's what the Shastra says. Right? But
that's the problem with this theory is there is no identical person that runs through different existences.
There is, because it's... No. That's not right.
It's constantly changing constellation of mental attitudes and tendencies and so on. And as we change our personality through our lifetime, it's a constant change.
What is changing? Yes, there's growth in terms of the mind, but there's no change in terms of the, first of all, the mind itself is pure sattva. Okay? It's sattva. That's the, if sattva, rajas, tamas, we say the mind is sattva. It is that reflecting material. It is never away from consciousness. Okay?
Yeah, so everything that relates immediately to consciousness doesn't change at all. That gives you a sense of identity.
Go ahead.
Yeah, otherwise you couldn't say, no. On the other hand, you have a constant changing mental constellation.
Yes, but look at, like, moment to moment to moment, you have a constantly changing mental constellation. You have this thought, negated by this thought, negated by this thought, but there's what we call a pratyabhijna. Pratyabhijna means that my mind can identify that this thought was my thought, and now this thought is my thought, now this thought is my thought. Because in every changing constellation, the self of that constellation is always the same conscious being.
Yeah, that means you refer to the absolute sense.
Yes, but the absolute...
doesn't change. But what about the personality?
But you're not referring to the absolute from the standpoint of jnanam. You're referring to the me that is in relationship to that thought. But the knowledge, when you get self-knowledge, that me... is Brahman. The me that you've taken to be the constant, the self of every changing thought, you recognize that that self is a constant. Until then, all you think of is that thought is me, then this thought is me, this thought is me. There's no viveka, there's no discrimination. When you gain knowledge, you recognize that there's a constant me that is actually changeless. But in either case, there is a recognition of me being the one who is the little girl, and then the teenager, and then the adult.
Yeah, that's to a great part of the mental construction.
The words are a mental construction.
Yeah, for instance, let's assume you run through a traumatic experience.
Yeah.
And you have to reevaluate your life and what you did.
Yes.
Then you recognize, after such a change, on the basis of which you have lived a long time, then looking back, you realize that the person before the change happened was a different one, and on top of it, we constantly reconstruct our past.
Yeah, but wait, you that's not quite right, though.
There's a way, and I say I want to bring it to this.
Okay, go ahead.
I think it's from Sartre. It says, man is the story that he makes upon his life. And once he's dead, other people tell the story who he was and what his life was.
Yeah.
So we are constantly constructing and reconstructing with every change in our psyche and biology.
That's right. I agree.
We reconstruct each other, and I'm not anymore the child that I was in 8 years, I was 14 and so on. I'm a completely different person. Now, most people think reincarnation means there is someone who remains the same all the life through, which isn't true, because we are constantly changing. It's just our memory that constructs a past in our thoughts that anticipates our future. So there's nothing stable in it, and insofar the idea of reincarnation is misleading, because it's not the same anymore. It's not the same identical person that enters from into another life or leaves this life. Only consciousness, the absolute self, remains the same.
Okay, well, that sounds very, very much like a Buddhist.
Yeah, well, how can you think it otherwise? You can observe it in your own life.
No, because what's being missed, what's being missed here is two orders of reality. Like the order of reality you're talking about is all of a change and growth and maturity, we can say, that the individual mind goes through. So that as you mature, you can say, you know, I'm very different than how I used to be.
Mm-hmm.
My values are different. How I see things are so different. That's the mind, the buddhi, going through a maturation process, growing from experience and all of that.
Yeah.
Or even negatively, you could say, I used to be so positive and now I'm angry and bitter. That's a negative type of modification.
Mm-hmm.
But now, when we're talking about that, we are talking about the maturation, or the opposite, of what the mind, the buddhi, is going through. And so it has to do with how the buddhi is assimilating experience.
Yeah.
Right? And as I assimilate experience, I change. My value system changes. If I'm assimilating experience in a positive way, I become more and more dharmic. But we're only talking, you know, about the antakarna, about the mind.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking, and that order of reality is what we call mithya. That order, okay. But the mithya has, just by the very fact that I use this word mithya, mithya must always have an adhishtana. It must be dependent on something for its being.
Yes, certainly.
And that, what it's dependent upon, is the satchitatma. The Atma, the self.
Yes.
Okay, that self is its truth.
Yes.
And so what lends conscious being to this maturing mind?
Yeah.
What lends conscious being is the changeless Satchitatma. But the maturing, changing mind, buddhi, that has an ahankara, that has an I notion, is going to say, me, I, this conscious being, right? That's the anyonya adyasa, that's the mutual superimposition. I, this conscious being, you know, am maturing, am changing as I go along.
Yeah.
But that's not, because it's totally identified.
That's not his question, though. I think he gets that distinction, and he's actually posed that as part of the question. His question is, what is it that reincarnates? Which is, we're all talking about, his question is within mitya. What is consistent that we can say that such a thing as reincarnation happens? Because there must be, otherwise, you know, if there's, who is it that reincarnates?
But wait a minute. If the mind, up to this point, the sukshma sharira, the subtle body up to this point, is the one who's maturing, enjoying conscious being.
Yeah.
That's the mitya to the satyam. When this physical body dies, the subtle body is what continues on.
Right.
Okay, that subtle body, whatever it is at that point, then collects more sent karma for itself to continue on.
Yeah,
you know.
But this subtle body is constantly changing.
Yes.
And the subtle body...
But right here now it's constantly changing.
Yes, that means... Or the past that I remember is in a constant change because the present memorizer...
That's fine. That's not a problem.
Yeah,
but
then that means our life is a made-up story of what we remember and put together.
So what?
Yeah, I mean, where's the identity? Now,
but the identity is always me.
Yeah,
see,
the absolute me, but I'm not talking about it.
But there is only the absolute me. There's no other me. The
this me is never born.
Yeah, but
never changes.
But it is the satyam. It is the truth of every experience I have. The mitya.
Yeah, no doubt about it. But I'm not talking about the absolute.
But you should be. You think that there's an absolute and then another me. There's
no
other me.
All the rest is mental fabrication.
Mental fabrication is all taking place in the absolute me.
Yeah, certainly, no doubt about it.
Okay.
But this is not my question. The absolute is not the problem. The problem is the change in personality.
Yeah, but the change in personality is always my personality.
Yeah, it's always my...
But the my personality, the my that we're referring to, is the Atma.
Yeah, but this way you cannot give an account of change, but only of identity. But I'm interested...
But that's not true. Look at if I use the clay pot example? If I take clay and I made it into a pot, and then I make it into a plate, and then I make it into a tumbler, the clay being is always the same.
But the shapes are not the same.
No, totally.
Okay.
But what is actually there is the same.
Yeah.
But what is?
But this is not my question.
Is there like an objective view what your identification is? I mean, when you grow, you can change your history by getting a wider view, you know, what is reality.
Yeah.
So, in former times you thought, oh, I'm a very bright person, and then you see, oh, this is a lack of something, and you change your history.
Right.
You get a different view, but the different view can also be wrong.
Yes.
Right? It
you
can
sure?
be a wrong notion you
totally.
Have about yourself.
Yeah.
But those notions, these tendency, how you see yourself, how you see the world and the history, this goes to the next life. Or those tendencies of thinking, how you see the world, how you value something, how you value yourself. This is sukshma sharira, and this goes to the next life.
Well, wait a minute. The sukshma sharira goes to the next life,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And what samskaras are relevant? Which ones are actually going to pass into the next life? What samskaras? I don't really know. It depends on what is dominant, and also what the sanchitta is, what is being drawn. Those samskaras that are dominant for you, those can pass into the next life. So we say, you know, and we say that based upon the Shruti and based upon your experiences of these prodigies and the difference, how some people are very talented at a young age in one thing and not another. Why are we drawn to these things instead of other things? We can say that is samskaras. It can also be the genes from your parents, you know.
Or a mixture,
right.
Or maybe they're the same.
Yeah,
the DNA might be the mechanism for transmitting some.
Maybe so.
I'm so
but
sorry. I don't want to.
I have to go to.
I don't want to ride the horse to death, as we say in German.
But we'll try one more ride, and then I've got
to
stop.
We say flog it to death. It's even worse.
Well, we'll do one more ride, but then I really have to leave because I'm doing a few things.
Stop at this point.
Just tell me. What
talk
is it?
About
Yeah. One more thing.
See, we have the illusion that we have an identity, a personal identity. I do not talk about Atman.
But that's where I disagree with you.
Yeah.
That's where I disagree, because this is the thing. Let me just say this one thing, and then I'll listen, okay? Because it bothers me. Your sense of me, your what you take to be your personal identity right now, is attributed to the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, and to your changing things. I'm saying no. The personal identity is in actuality the Atma. That's what you don't know. What you take to be you, the growing, changing you, that essential being that is growing and changing, I'm saying that growing and changing is all mithya, the essential being is constant, that you take to be you.
But when people talk about a coming birth in another life, or a previous life, they are referring to mithya, don't they?
Only partially, because what they're really referring to is the me, the conscious being,
which never changes,
who is the self of all of those experiences. That's what they're really referring to. And then in terms of the mithya, there's changing experiences going on, but it's always, they're always mine. No matter, in this life, all experiences are mine. Going into the next life, all experiences are mine. The mind that's being referred to is the Atma.
And this mind is constantly changing. There's no identity except the mind itself.
No.
But the contents of mind are constantly changing.
No, you can't say that, because the self of the mind is always there as the pratyabhijna, as the one who is the same. Like, this is my thought, this is my thought, this is my thought. I used to be like this, now I'm like this, now I'm like that. That I that is being referred to as the constant me is the Atma. That's the viveka that needs to take place. You're putting what is me, what is really the Brahman, you're putting that, you're giving that to the sukshma sharira, to the changing, to the growing individual. I'm saying what is me is in fact Brahman, and that is never changing, but the sukshma sharira with all of the thoughts, etc., are changing.
But Carol, that me is a mental thought that he's talking about.
It isn't a mental thought. The me that you think is a mental thought, the word I is a mental thought.
Right.
But the self of it is not a mental thought. The self of it is satyam. That you think it's a mental thought is the problem. That's the problem. That's the anyonya, that's a mutual superimposition that we're suffering from. That you think this me that is me is really the changing, maturing person. And it isn't. The me is Brahman. Om Tat Sat. Om Swasti Prajabhya Paripalyantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha Go Brahmane Bhyashivamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamcho Barahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukha bhag bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityor ma amritam gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.